Tom. Call the order of the regular and supplemental meeting. The first thing I'd like to do is to welcome our new trustees. Just give a little thrill to have you. Maybe each of you could just give, you know, a quick introduction, quick bio, that sort of thing. Nancy, you want to go first?
Oh, sure. I'm Nancy Rocha. I've been in the financial industry for about 24 years now. I started when I was 15. I have a background in fixed income, particularly municipal bonds. I've done a lot of work with pension plans. I'm originally from San Antonio, live in Fort Worth. When I'm not chasing business, I'm trying to make effective change where I can for the betterment of this plan and other service-oriented tasks that I have. So I'm very, very happy and feel fortunate to be part of this group and look forward to working with everyone. Thanks.
Great. I just put a list of Tony. You can go next.
Yeah, sure. So I'm Tony Scaluzzo. I am new to Texas. I've been here about 7 years. I grew up in Chicago. My wife is from East Texas, which is partially why we're here. Our company also has a location here. I've worked in banking and finance my entire 20 years. I work for a small private equity firm now that focuses on financial services and really community banking in particular. So it's a very odd or, you know, unique focus. I did the CFA program. I went to Iowa for undergrad, studied finance, and went to business school in Chicago and studied finance. So kind of tripled down on finance. But this involvement for me is very personal. I've got a lot of family, father that was former police officer in Chicago, and litany of cousins that were Chicago police and fire. So dedicating my time to this organization is, like I said, very personal and important to me. So I'm very happy to be here.
Marcus?
My name's Marcus Smith. I'm a partner at Garcia Hamilton in Houston. So I will be coming up every night on the nights before the meeting to attend the meeting. I have been in the business for a long time. I graduated from Howard University in D.C., and after that I went and worked on Wall Street. I've worked at a private equity firm in Houston, and at one point worked at Enron down in Houston when it was really a hot commodity and place to be. Very glad to be on the board and excited to really learn and be as helpful as I possibly can.
Well, I compliment all three of you. None of your profile pictures appear to be more than 5 or 10 years old. A lot of times we have people that submit very, very dated photos for these things. So that's a great start. So we're going to go ahead and kind of go back to a sort of our normal mode and have a moment of silence for those that are not with us anymore. Thank you. Now we'd like to move to the consent agenda, starting with the minutes of the regular meeting of August 11th. Any comments on those? If not, can we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. The detailed consent agenda, Kelly, anything you want to flag?
The last item on the agenda is actually pretty unusual. This is related to the drop in 2015 when there was an opportunity for people to get out of drop. We call it a drop undo or revocation. Most of those people that had done that had paid back their contributions, but they can do that really any time before they retire. So this is one person that is doing that now, which is pretty unusual. But other than that, standard.
What's the dollar magnitude?
$853.
Okay.
I thought you were going to say thousands.
Yeah.
I was actually surprised. It usually is way much, much bigger.
Okay. All right. We have a motion to approve the consent agenda. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion carries. Now we're going to go to public comment. We have someone who'd like to speak to us. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, trustees. My name is David Ellis. I want to welcome our three new trustees who joined us this morning. As a person sitting on the nomination committee, I got to meet all three of them. I want to say that this is very impressive, all three of them. You all three have big shoes to fill, but I feel very confident in what I saw at the nomination committee. I think you've got some good people to fill. So first off, welcome to our board. And I also want to say that last night on the news, I saw the board of general level news, it looks like we have some education to do because the city council had approved $16 million for pension fund stabilization. And I don't know the $16 million, how far that's going to go. But they did, there was some more discussion on there, and I think the final figure I heard was between the two plans, the ERF and Dallas Police and Fire Pension, it was like $5 billion unfunded liability. At least some of them are aware of it, but we still have some education to do. Again, thank you for your service and look forward to working.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Great, thanks.
Well said. Okay, now we're going to go to item D. Mike,
great.
Good to have you on the pitcher's mound. You're going to do a portfolio update.
Thanks. So everyone who's new, Mike Yan. Senior investment officer filling in for our CIO Ryan Wagner today. So I'm going to go through the portfolio update, and then Makita will follow up with their markets update. So I want to remind everybody that our top focus currently is to liquidate our private market asset portfolio. Here to date, we have liquidated $53.6 million. And we expect to liquidate another $20 million in September from AEW. That's our real estate, our largest real estate holding. A quick update on the EM debt search that we completed in July. We selected MetLife, and we're currently working on contracting. And we expect the fund by the end of the month. That'll be a 4% allocation at $70 million. The safety reserve is currently in drawdown mode since the March board, and we'll continue to do so. We'll touch on that later. We are also working on redeploying those private market asset proceeds to the public equity. In August, we allocated $8.3 million to small cap equity. So far, year-to-date return as of 8/29 are negative 9.6 for the whole portfolio, negative 11.4 for the public market ex cash, which account for 67% of our assets. Here's our bridge chart. You'll see that at 8/29 we had $1.7 billion in the pension, and it was down $35 million in August. Since the beginning of the year, we've had $76 million in benefit outflows and $188 million in investment losses. This chart shows the drawdown of equities off their highs. You can see that the S&P has performed the best relatively at negative 17.8%. The NASDAQ has been the worst. It's been pretty choppy all year, and August was initially up and then down. The slides we show every time that just reminds us of the S&P intra-year decline. You can see the max drawdown this year was at 24%. We're currently at 17% for the S&P. And you can see at the end of the year, a lot of times it does come up to be positive. Not saying that that'll happen this time for sure. Here's our public market performance snapshot. You can see here that year-to-date, the portfolio has outperformed the benchmark. We're down 11.4% relative to 16%. For global equities, The story is a little bit different. We're down 18.3% relative to the benchmark, which is down 16.7%. That underperformance is attributed to our growth managers underperforming more than our value managers have been able to outperform. Bright spot in equities, RBC, our EM equity manager, outperformed by 1.8%. As far as fixed income, we've had significant outperformance. We're down 9.2% relative to the benchmark that's down 15.1%. That's mainly due to the shorter duration of our portfolio.
How does that work, Michael? I mean, we're down 9.2 versus 15, but if you look at all the individual managers, they're either at or below their index. So how do we get an aggregate that's better?
So I think it's a composition of the multiverse relative to
the multiverse is.
But the multiverse is a separate index, so you have just a very broad and generic benchmark for your total fixed income composite, but each of the parts has a different benchmark. So there's a bit of a mismatch. It's kind of similar to having an MSCI World Country World Index, and maybe you have domestic and regional exposures that you don't have that same benchmark.
So I guess our allocation within each of these sections is so different from the broader index that ends up in that area?
Yeah, I think we, you know that our portfolio is really heavily weighted in IRM versus the index isn't going to have that much of an allocation to short term.
Okay.
And that's been great.
So said another way, the safety reserve acted not only as a liquidity safety reserve, it acted as a return safety reserve too, to at least for a short period of time, not a way to live your investment life, but not a bad way to camp out during a tough time.
Yeah, that's right.
Speaking of the safety reserve, so we'll touch on that. So the safety reserve currently has $139 million in it. It's composed of cash and short-term treasuries. We have $54 million in cash, $85 million in short-term investment grade. We estimate that we have $9.3 million of monthly benefit outflows. So given the safety reserve, the estimate is that we have enough cash to cover benefit payments until November 2023.
So I don't know if the new trustees, but that's a net outflow of payouts above contributions are being received.
Mm-hmm. And given the split between cash and investment grade, a short-term investment grade bond, we will replenish our cash position from that short-term investment grade position as needed.
I have a quick question, Michael, and I had been meaning to ask earlier. The outflows during COVID, did that increase? Has it pretty much stayed at 9.3 per month, or was there a spike during the COVID year?
It stayed the same, roughly the same. What increases that over time is as we have more retirement. So our contributions are really set from the city, and because there were public safety, even on the employee side, we didn't lose anything there. The police and fire were still working. So the contributions are set and the benefits are set. So over time, that amount really just increases. Well, we'll continue to increase as more and more people retire.
I guess that's where I was getting that during COVID, did you see more spike in retirement?
Not really. I mean, actually, I could go back and look at that. But we had such an increase in retirements in 16 and 17 that I think it was depressed a little bit for the next couple years. And I'll look at what actually happened in 2020 because we do track that, 2020 and 2021.
And do we have like a projection of, roughly when we might see have a chunk greater than maybe, in 5 years, 10 years, what is
that? We have that chart that's a long-term chart that shows the funding status over between the next 50 years.
Right.
That probably would be helpful for the trustees. But we're going to go negative for a while before we start to turn the corner.
So we do have in the Siegel data, when they do their evaluation every year, I always ask for an Excel spreadsheet, which has all of the various numbers going all the way out until, I think, this last year, 2084, whenever it was we're expected to be funded. And I always do take a look at that, and that's really how we project. The contributions are expected to go up after this year, really 2.5% a year, or in the evaluation, it's expected to go up based on the city's hiring plan,
mm-hmm.
and then 2.5% a year after the hiring plan. And then the on the expense side, the benefit side, is based on the demographics of the plan, and Siegel builds that in, and that's what we look at.
Okay.
That number will continue to get bigger
okay.
until the real expensive group falls off the system, which will be a very long time.
Great. We'll move to asset allocation. Here you can see we're significantly underweight to global equities, very overweight to private equity, real estate, natural resources, and infrastructure, our private assets. Next slide gives you more of a breakdown. What I want to highlight here is that if you look at global equities, the bottom two, Eastern Shore and Global Alpha, those are our two small cap managers we just initiated within the last year. We initially funded them 50% of the way, and we are currently working on getting those up to target with the private market proceeds. This is our chart that shows asset class returns by year, show it every month, but key point to note, year to date, the only thing really positive is commodities as an asset class. And our schedule for the rest of the year for board investment reviews, we're going to do fixed income in October, public equity in November, and private equity and debt in December. Do you have any questions before I hand it off to Nikita?
Leo and Aaron, great to have you all here today. So
while they're passing the remote control off for the new people, I'll just let you know, you might have seen in your Diligent or your PDF, whichever you're looking at, there's one Makita presentation that is in open session, and in that presentation there isn't detail on real estate investments, but then there's also a closed presentation. So if you're looking at the PDF, the closed presentation starts at page 97. If you've got specific questions related to anything in the closed presentation, we can go into closed session and talk about that. But generally, Makita goes over the open presentation.
Thank you, Kelly, and good morning, and pleased to be here. Welcome to the new trustees. If you have any questions about anything that is reported related to performance, we're also accessible. We've been working with the system for about 4 years.
So, Kelly, what's the reason for the differentiation between open and closed?
We don't put our real estate values out in the public because it could impact a sale, potential sale. So there's certain information that by law we're able to keep enclosed in closed session. Those are very limited things. So most things we talk about are in open session.
And so we've been working with the staff over the years and with the trustees to try to make our presentation very concise and focus on the key highlights. So this is a one-page snapshot, just looks at the last year. Sometimes we choose the quarterly update. In this case, given the end of the fiscal year, we chose the 1 year. You'll see at the top for the year that ended June 30th. Negative performance, of course, driven by what happened primarily in the second half of the fiscal year or the first half of this calendar year. And to put things into perspective, this was the third worst start on record for equities in the U.S. You had to go back to the Depression era to find 2 6-month periods with weaker performance. And to complement that, this was the worst start on record for bonds. A wide margin. You have to go back to other periods with maybe 2 to 3% yearly losses, and in the first 6 months, if you look at core bonds, they lost 10% due to the rapid increase in rates and the starting point, which was very low. So those two things combined brought down performance that comprises a good chunk for most investors, those that are more diversified and have illiquid assets, it tends to be a lag, and so eventually, you know, there may be some corrections there as well. So here, the second quarter of 2022 is really not shown because, again, there is a lag. So we'll see how that affects some of your holdings.
Sort of interesting that, I mean, our minus 11.4 versus the median is 9.6, yet the 60-40 portfolio is down 15.9. I guess that's their private investment.
And the liquids
that have done better than the markets.
Yeah, because today most of your peers would have anywhere from 20, 30, 40% in all of the liquids combined, from real estate to private equity, some hedge funds and whatnot, and some of those are not even repriced yet.
But they have positive returns, or flat and negative.
Yeah, and not during the year, some of your peers may have captured gains in the third and fourth quarter greater than you. Now, to put things into perspective, in the last quarter of the fiscal year, so essentially the most recent quarter that ended June 30th, you outperformed by a fairly wide margin. This fund lost 7.7%. Many peers lost double digits. So that helps to some degree, but when you compound that loss with lower captures of gains at the beginning of the fiscal year, you end up, again, below the pack. And we'll look at attribution, but private equity continues to be a primary detractor, not in terms of the allocation, but in terms of the execution. So let's skip over to page 36. Here you see the performance, again, the quarter on the left, 7.7 versus 10.5 for the policy benchmark. For the year to date, the first 6 months still ahead, but once you get into a year and later, it lags. And we've seen this at other time periods at the beginning of 2020, in late 2018, when there's a massive sell-off in the market. This fund looks better on a relative basis, still posting losses, and when the market rallies, you tend to not rise as much. I would say that, you know, in the longer term, the weight of those liquid holdings that we call your legacy positions have been a primary detractor of performance. The public markets, which now comprise 67%, but when we came on board, it was a much smaller piece. Those have tracked very well, and at times they're a bit ahead, at times they're a bit below, but no surprise there. Here's the attribution when we look at the most recent quarter. So if you look at global equity, being underweight help, that's the blue line on the second row. Anything to the right means value added. Blue means asset allocation decisions, which could be active or passively made in the sense that you had no choice and that's the way you were. And then green means skill or value add through the actual managers that you own versus through benchmarks. And so you see that that comprises about half or explains half of the outperformance, being underweight equities when they did poorly, but your managers actually outperforming their benchmarks overall. The rest is a bit of a wash, but also the allocation to real estate helps to some degree in this analysis because real estate did fairly well and you were overweight, so you'll see that to the right. During the year, it is much more representative of what has happened over the past few years. Private equity and real estate to the left because of poor performance of the actual holdings in the fund. Those positions have been overweight, and that has been a net positive when you look at this attribution analysis. That's what you see, the blue lines to the right. The dot is a combination of the two. So if you look at the top line for the total fund, some of those allocations help, but they were more than offset by poor performance within the actual holdings, such that the net loss was about 1.2%. We can skip to, page. My last comment would be on this page. Here's the trend. A lot has happened. A lot has changed since we came on board. probably the change began about 1 or 2 years prior, I would say since 2016, 2017. At that time, the fund engaged in the selling of some positions in the secondary market, and the focus, as Mike mentioned, was to capture distributions, monetize some of those illiquid holdings, and move to a much more traditional pension fund weights with maybe 15% allocation to illiquid. So you'll see the trends on the real assets, mostly real estate, getting smaller over time, private equity also getting smaller, and the big change is the blue line at the top. It was less than 20% allocation to stocks. Now it's about half of your total portfolio. To the right, you'll see the area we're aiming towards, and you'll see much smaller allocation to the liquid. So we'll continue to redeploy into stock and bonds over the coming quarters. With that, I'll pause if anybody has any questions. That will move into the private market.
Thanks, Leo. So, this next report is the summary of just the closed-end investments, all your private market investments. And I've had this spiel to some of the trustees before, but you know that date is accurate, March 31st. So, the cadence we've been on is we present the total fund quarterly report, and then the private markets report is generally a one-quarter lag. This is due to the reporting cycle of these investments. So private equity, private real estate, usually 60 to 90 days after the valuation date is when you get the marks. So these are the actual NAVs reported by the managers for March 31st, 2022. So it's not overly helpful in terms of a current snapshot. It's a good line in the sand. You see where you were at a certain point, and it still provides information on kind of where your exposure is and you know which funds have performed and which ones have lagged. Another important thing is this report is all the remaining investments. So funds that were committed, called, invested, and fully liquidated are not included in this report. There's a page, two pages at the end that lists every final fund, but this is the current exposure. You'll see here biggest remaining weights are to real estate in orange and private equity in pink. And those are kind of the two asset classes with some kind of potential binary outcome assets in there where we, you know, they could end up successful or could be really negative. The blue agriculture, I'd argue, is some of your healthiest assets. That's the Hancock portfolio. I think you went over that last board meeting. And then you got infrastructure and a smaller weight to timber, one asset left there. This shows the performance and the multiples. So this is, so the blue bar is the amount distributed relative to the amount invested. So if you see the one on the axis, if you are above the one, that means every dollar you put in has already been returned to the system. The green bar factors in all the distributions plus what's remaining in terms of values that are still out there but yet to be liquidated and returned. So what you hope for is you want the blue to certainly end over the one, meaning you got your money back, and the blue should kind of, if you see it through its whole life, should creep up and creep up to kind of end up where the green is. So agriculture has been a big success. The others, and we don't beat the dead horse too much, but you can see very far from earning the capital back, and even the green bars, which is the remaining value, still generally are hovering below one.
Why did you guys pick multiples to rate here instead of IRR?
simplicity of the reporting. The IRRs are coming up. So here we show IRR in the final right column and a host of other numbers. The takeaway really is, so $1.5 billion committed here. See the gray at the bottom. You received back $900 million. Valuation left of around $545 million. So go all the way to the right and you see the DVPI and the IRR. So that's basically saying on this $1.5 billion, basically earned zero return. So the TVPI is your multiple, so just shy of 1.0, and an IRR of 0.3, so basically close to zero. So we all know the story. We're working hard to get out of these investments, but the success of, you know, I think good decisions made by the board on the public side just repeatedly will continue to be overshadowed by this anchor until we finally can kind of shed these assets and get a healthy private market portfolio.
And just to add one more concept of that, you know, would you say this is on average probably 10-year money in terms of how long, if we say an average life of that $1.5 billion, it's probably a high single digit to low double digit, I would think, in that range, in terms of how long that money has been invested on average?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, most of it was 05, 06,
yeah.
07.
So if you just use, like, the rule that, you know, I think every you earn 7%, you double your money in 10 years, and you say we have $1.5 billion tied up in this, I mean, that's $1.5 billion that we didn't earn. And so when you look at, you know, the unfunded, and officer, you know, points that out, you know, correctly, and you think about, you know, what happened, you know, that hits you kind of first and foremost. There's all sorts of other issues, but, you know, and we own those decisions that were made, you know, before us in terms of the outcomes and working through those. And this team has done quite a bit. I think without their efforts, we'd be looking at materially lower numbers. And in addition, they've generated a lot of liquidity that has helped along the way. Not selling things at low bargain prices, but working through things and trying to, you know, balance out maintaining value with generating liquidity. So, you know, and this is something that we've all been laser focused on really since day one. The investment team has a really good comprehensive schedule that shows the bridge and the estimates of cash flow that we generated every year. So we deal with it on an individual line item basis all the time. We deal with it, like here we're talking about it more in the macro. But there's probably nothing that we've looked at, talked about, work through more than this general topic.
Yeah, to Nick's point, that kind of validates that last slide Leo pointed out with the colors showing that it's, you know, it's a slow process getting that money back, but then the positive is, you know, you have this distributions number has increased and increased and increased over the years of the new board and back into healthy performing assets.
Yeah, when I talk about Bill, I'm not talking about when Bill was chairman. So
the dark days.
Yeah, dude, actually before Bill too. So.
So there's a whole host of things that play into this, but as you look at the go forward or marginal kind of role of private equity or alternatives in the portfolio, it's lower compared to peers, and there's probably some, you know, legacy emotional issues related to that, but alternatives as an asset class are a higher returning performing piece of the average pension plan. Is our desire to be lower in private equity a result of historical issues, or is it a marginal decision looking forward, say?
I mean, we're trying to get back to a reasonable number, and but these are sort of dead investments, and we want to get back into where we can allocate an average amount to producing assets, basically. But we have given that, and our liquidity issue was trying to balance that. So staff is now looking at when do we start to be able to reinvest in some of the better performing, but to avoid some of the things we've done in the past, which is very large percentages of some partnerships that didn't do very well.
Oh, yeah, sure. And again, I mean, we could all sit here and talk all day about legacy decisions, but there are a lot of simple core private equity firms that are even local that are very good, right, that would provide superior returns to what we're generating here. But anyhow, that's helpful. Thank you.
Yeah, there's always going to be individual investments in like private equity is such a dispersion between best and worst, whereas in other asset classes, it's a lot tighter. I personally think this year will be incredibly interesting to see how private equity firms mark investments that they haven't monetized, because really since these pension funds have really increased their exposure to alternatives, we haven't had a prolonged downturn. We did have COVID, but that was a bounce, you know, whip down, whip back up pretty fast. We haven't had a year or a multi-year period. So I'll be interested in what the numbers show, you know, assuming we don't have markets rebounding as we get to year end and next year and so on in the private markets, and, you know, interested in what you guys would say about that as well.
Yeah, so lots of things to share on this topic. So first of all, I would argue the what you call, Anthony, relatively small allocation to liquid versus peers is a combination of two primary forces. Force number one is these much larger legacy liquid holdings with an uncertain payoff and uncertain size of that payoff. And so it's hard to forecast into the future how much we should be putting today, because some of these assets could have binary outcomes, and we still won't know what the final solution will be for some of those. Number two, I think it also plays to the, you know, the history of this fund and some of the situation in terms of future cash flows, contributions, and whatnot. I don't think we can afford another set of missteps. And so better to start walk, then you jog, then you run. With that said, we are beginning conversations with the staff, and eventually it's going to go to the Investment Advisory Committee and eventually to the board. At some point in time, we'll have to make a set of new commitments to these as a class. Since 2018, since we arrived here, there's been zero. No new commitments. There may be none for at least another year, but at some point in time, we will. And so we have to be proactive in terms of discussing options and alternatives. One thing I can point, and this shouldn't be a surprise, but Aaron, can we go to page 65? Sorry, the PDF, keep going. Here. If you look at the commitment amounts, they're all over the map. We at Nikita believe once you figure out what is your annual budget and we figure out an approach, you pretty much allocate the same amount, maybe 10 or 20 million per fund, and you do five funds and you go constant. You don't put 5 million in one, 100 or another. And somebody mentioned earlier, I think it was you, Bill, having very large positions within a fund. I think you want to also cap your position so that you don't become too large a player in a fund as well. So some very simple risk management practices can go a long way in terms of minimizing some negative surprises. So it will be a topic we'll come back to the board likely at some point in time in 2023 and the ISC before that.
Yeah, I guess I'm new and I've got fresh eyes, right? I mean, to me, the problem is not the asset class, it's the managers that we have.
The execution, of course. And Nick mentioned that there's a huge dispersion, and so we have to make sure no mistakes get made again.
The problem is the asset managers and the concentration made a lot of big bets with certain people that didn't come about. So getting diversification as well as picking the appropriate managers is key going forward.
Yeah, sure. And I think, you know, there's plenty of studies out there in terms of alpha, the real alpha generation for the asset class. But even if you just look at the absolute return, for the asset class, it's still on par with public equity or slightly higher, right?
Yeah. And there is one more thing. The consistency of deployment of capital has been such that when the markets have been rising, more and more money goes in to then buy assets at the peak. So it's not shown here, but my recollection is, and my suspicion is, that in 06, 07, 08, a ton of money was committed. And then 09, 10, 11, maybe none too little, which those may have been the best times to put money to work. So that's why, again, a consistent pacing year after year, we shouldn't be timing the markets. We don't even control the cash flows once we make the commitment. So no point in sizing up or down according to exogenous factors.
Yeah, on the point of dispersion of results, just look at the farthest right column, the IRR. I mean, it goes from minus 99% loss to an IRR of 33%. So you do have... Yeah.
What page are you on, Aaron?
This is 67.
67, okay, thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, the smallest font page, of course.
Yeah, but that, again, is just within
and this
the
is
ones
just,
we've chosen.
Oh, yeah, of course, yes. Yeah. And I think Makita agrees, and I think the board agrees with you, that this is not an asset class problem. This was a selection problem from 15 years ago that has been inherited.
The other issue with private equity and these sorts of things is that once you have an established program, just to that point, it's not just the pacing issue, but it's the cash management issue, because when you're making commitments every year of a certain size, then you're not getting even distributions, but you're getting distributions every year. The problem is that when you restart something, let's say you make a $25 million commitment, it's a five-year drawdown, okay? What do we decide to do with that money that they can call at any point in time? Where do we put it? How do we deal with liquidity? You know, all these IRRs are done on once the money's drawn in. It doesn't take into account what you do while you're waiting for them to draw it. And, you know, those become really, really difficult things to do. Once again, if you have an established program and you're churning out some level of distributions every year, it mitigates a lot of it. But those are all, you know, that's why I think IRR should never be the only thing you look at with private equity. I look at, you know, the multiples and how quickly it's drawn and things like that.
I read this, an old article from Howard Marks on the flight here. I think it was like 15 years old, but 15 pages on that exact topic, that you think you can't eat IRR is what it was called, but you have to look at everything. And so that's why, you know, these reports aren't, I'd love to be simple, here's the results, but it's 30 pages of different ways of skinning the cat. So the final point is just on kind of, for the new trustees, what you see in this report. So, you know, going back to the beginning, page 4, you have, this is the summary, and then there's the same format for each asset class. You go under the hood. So private equity, you start with, here's the breakdown of remaining exposure, you get your multiple chart, and then you get your IRRs and cash flows. And then this repeats for each other private market asset class. To my point, you know, it's dated, but it still generates this good conversation, and you can evaluate, you know, a million different things in terms of how the program is put together and how it's performing.
How were marks in the first quarter relative to the stock market decline of private equity? What were your observations on what you saw?
First quarter, nothing moved. You started seeing some decrease in the second quarter for private equity more broadly.
But, I mean, anywhere close
to
how much the stock market moved?
No. A couple of percentage points, what I saw.
Yeah, in the first quarter, maybe 4% negative corrections. And for the second quarter, the numbers are coming down.
Yeah, so I mean, that.
Negative.
So you're measuring inconsistent data when you're combining public equity returns and private marks. If private marks haven't moved, there's a lot more scrutiny in year-end audits than there are in interim quarters. And so it makes it very difficult to make overall conclusions.
Yes, you have to take a long-term view on a quarter-by-quarter basis. You know, a lot of noise. And Yeah, there's some judgment. I mean, there's valuation policies at each GPE.
Well, these funds are all raising new funds all the time, too, so they're not, you know, there's a marketing element to it as well.
Sure, but
yeah.
It will be rare. I mean, most tend to be, no GPE wants to provide a negative surprise, so you tend to see the value kept in the box tend to be lower than the final exit. That's what normally happens, especially with good performing funds. When you have the opposite and the value of an asset is at a value higher than it then gets exited, that's pretty negative for everybody and a good indication that likely that GP will not be raising a new fund.
Yeah, which is why I think this year will be interesting to see what happens because they have not had to actually do that yet.
Correct. We'll see. If there's a quick rebound, then, again, we'll go back to 2020, not a big deal. But if we get into a pronounced period like 07, 08, 09, then, agree. That concludes our prepared remarks. Happy to take any questions.
And these guys have been great. They're very responsive. You know, any questions you have, always feel free to contact. There's no, protocol to that. And they provide good data. We've had some others, but these two have been our team, and overall it's been real good and very responsive. Gilbert had a bunch of questions, queries, challenges, whatever, and I think you guys responded well, and it's all stuff that we're reviewing and looking at. So I think we've had really good back and forth. Anything else? Okay. All right. Next, we have board committee appointments with new people. I want to go ahead and do a motion on these and go over these, but we can adjust them going forward. So just because we're going to do a motion on them right now doesn't mean that's necessarily locked in that way for the year. But in order to just get something expedited now, I'd like to do that. For Tony and Marcus, I apologize I didn't visit with you before and say this is where we'd like to slot you. But the way we're looking at it right now is that Bill is going to take over the IAC for Gilbert. And as a result of that, Nancy, since you've gone from an external to a board member, we're going to ask that you go to the audit committee, which I'll replace Bill as the chair. And then Steve, I haven't spoken to him yet. We want him to chair the professional services committee. And then, Tony, have you and Marcus on that. And once again, all this stuff can move around. We have certain numbers we want to fill. For the purposes of locking in something today, this is what we'd like to do.
So moved.
Okay, so motion. We have a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries.
Do we have a – this isn't in the book, is it?
No, it's not because I didn't know if we were going to move it around.
Can we
today.
Get a printout of that now so we know who's on what committee? So.
Right. And I did provide the new trustees the committee policy, and we talked about it at their orientation, so –
Because the IAC, I mean, I can't read it from this distance, so just was curious what our composition is.
The IAC is you, Bill, as chair, and it's Michael Brown and Ken, and they'll stay on like this. Ken's term it ends in 2023, and I think so does Michael. Oh, I got it right there. Michael's serving in a holdover trustee position right now. I'm assuming the mayor's going to reappoint him, but Ken will have to run again for his position at the end of 2022. So.
Okay, if we can just get a makeup of it, that would be helpful.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let me talk about another set, but I just wondered if they could be expanded.
So
one of the issues is the majority of the members have got to be non-trustees. And I don't know how many non-trustees are on there now.
Well, so, and we actually talked about having four board members, but what we ended up having, we had most of our meetings, we were not able to have a quorum because we only had one extra outside member, and then if one of the outside members couldn't attend a meeting, we wouldn't have a quorum at the meeting. So we try to have a cushion of two. We could expand it. We don't want it to get unruly, I think, was what we're trying to balance. So right now there's, since your position went from external, now you would be an internal, we have six external slots, and we have three board members, is where it is at this point. But if the board chooses to, we can expand it. But if today we went to four and we currently have five external seated, one of those external people can't attend the meeting, we won't have a quorum. That's the issue that we have.
And that's happened most of the time.
Most of the time.
Yeah.
And,
I think
and
we had a bog down last year, didn't we?
What?
We had a bog down last year because we had some externals that weren't able to attend the meetings, and it prevented us from getting some work done.
Right, and we just, the minutes just don't look great when you don't have a quorum, don't have a quorum, don't have a quorum. Someone can interpret that at the legislature to mean people don't care or something, which really isn't the case. It's really about numbers.
Right. We have five non-trustees right now. Then?
Right. We have Rakesh, Scott Freeman, Bob Jones, Ryan Bailey, and Tom Toll. But we can consider what we want to do.
All right, moving on. Brenda, financial audit staff.
Thank you, Nick. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
The financial audits are still in a holding pattern at this point. As I reported last month, we are still waiting on receiving the audited financials from the HUF funds. They are material to the pension, and we need to have them in order to complete our audit. Those financials were promised to us in July. We did not receive them. We have asked multiple times for an update and have not received a response from the HUF funds on when we can expect to receive those audited financials. In the meantime, we are continuing to work on what we can on both the audited financials and on the ACFR. So that we will be as well positioned as possible when we do receive those funds to complete our financials. At that point, we'll send the information to the actuary. It'll take the actuary about 30 days to complete their work. Then we'll receive the work back. It has to be reviewed by BDO, our auditors. So from the time we receive the audited financials from HUF, you're looking at about 60 days until we're able to complete the DPSP financials. Any questions?
Do we have the financials we need from Lone Star then at this point?
So for two of the funds we do, the third fund, we are in the process of writing a valuation memo that we'll submit to BDO. We did receive audited financials from them. We are presenting our own valuation. And we'll get that approved by BDO. So we're almost to the point where we're ready to submit that.
Okay.
So Lone Star would be taken care of, and it is just down to HUF.
Down to HUF.
And then but Jeff Wayne.
He is on standby, and he can't do any – he can't continue his process until
okay.
he gets assets. But they have done the work related to the demographic pieces.
Got it.
Once he gets it, is it 3 weeks he needs?
Three to four weeks. I mean, we'll probably have the preliminary report in 3 weeks, and we usually take a week to go through it, review it, have conversations, and then we'll get the final report.
And then Melissa takes it and does an amazing job of turning it into an annual report, which you always look forward to seeing her style in that. So what she has in mind this year, she's not telling us yet.
She is in progress. We meet biweekly to look at where she's at, as well as to look at the other sections of the ACFR that we'll do. But she is working diligently, presented us some ideas, and so I think you'll be pleased with the end product.
We'll be amazed. Kelly, monthly contribution report.
Okay, on page 84 of your materials, is the contribution report. This is a standard report. provide to the board at every meeting. And when we did the orientation for the new trustees, we talked about how important the contributions are for the funding of the plan, and that's why we have this report that we monitor. So on page 84, it's just a summary page, shows these graphs. It's really hard to tell what's changing a lot in the graphs, but I always have a bullet. It's usually the last bullet here on the top part of the page that says, where are we with the number of police and fire that the city expected to have during this time period? These reports have about a two-month lag. This is a September with July data. And on the July payroll, we had 159 fewer employees than the hiring plan anticipated that we would. Fire was over their estimate, and police is way under their estimate. The page, the next page, which is page 85, that's really the meat of the report and the page that changes the most, so I will just spend a minute for the new trustees to go over this. So the top of the page talks about city contributions, and the bottom of the page is employee contributions. And the difference between the two is really the column, which is the third column over, called HB 3158-4. So when we did the bill, I think we talked about this in the orientation, in 2017, there's a period of 7 years where there's a floor of the contribution. So it doesn't matter what the city's payroll is on the city side, they have to give us at least a certain amount of contributions a month, and that's what this floor indicates. We also, and if you want to see what the floor is and how it changes over time, that's on the next page, page 86. At the top of the page here talks about the floor and the hiring plan and what the estimates were. And one of the things I'd like to point you to is if you look at the top of this page on 2022, if you the floor currently is each biweekly pay period is $6,043,000. And then you'll see it goes down in 2023 and 2024 to actually equal the hiring plan numbers in the next column. So essentially after 2022, what that means is the floor is gone. Because we have been consistently, going back to the other page, in the last column you can see we've been over the hiring plan estimates for every period, month to date, you know, current month, year to date, and since the bill has gone into effect. So basically the floor will no longer be a factor, although it has contributed $47 million extra to the plan since it's been in place. So it's been a good thing. Unfortunately, we tried to get it 20 years into the bill, and that didn't work. So that's what this report is. We continue to monitor contributions because it's just very important. The next page is really that we just looked at. This doesn't change. It's really just for your information so you can say what's happening with the floor or the hiring plan. We did talk about the hiring plan, and we talked about a whole bunch during your orientation, but one of the things I just wanted to remind you of, this hiring plan has nothing to do with what the city currently estimates they will hire or plan to hire. It has to do with a set of numbers for salaries and people that they estimated in 2017. And that's what we compare it against. The next page just talks about actuarial changes. If we're changing any assumptions, this hasn't changed for a while, so you won't likely see any changes on this unless we talk about it when Siegel's here, once we get the audit done. This last page is just a summary by year on the top part and by month on comp pay, and which drives the pension benefits and the number of people. So that's really the report. Not much changes other than that second page. So if you want to focus there, that's good. One of the things I did want to point out, I don't think we talked about this in the orientation, we get pension contributions on what we call computation pay, or comp pay for short. And what that is it's the employee's base salary plus education pay plus longevity. It doesn't include overtime. It doesn't include any other types of incentives that might be out there. So if you see that the police or fire are getting good big raises, that's really helpful to us. But I provided you all an article that was in the paper yesterday just for your information about their challenges with hiring. And they talk about giving $4 million of incentives. I have a feeling those incentives are something that will not be pensionable, but I don't know what those are yet. I have a message into the city to find out. So we really monitor what they're doing on their pay plan. We like, it's important to us that they keep these experienced, high-paid employees, so we're very supportive of that, but we want to make sure they're balancing the pension needs as well as the city's needs. So that's really this report. Are there questions about this?
I've got a question on the floor, because I saw the same news article or same news story last night, and I got a call immediately after, and I guess without getting too many legal questions, and if I do, Josh, we've got to go to closed session, just let me know, and I'll, you know, remove the question. But it appears the city council or the mayor, or, not the mayor, but the city manager wants to, what I call, massage the budget a little bit and pull the money that goes to our floor over to their ideas. So I guess my question is getting made, can they do that, and then what are our recourses? Would a phone call work that says they can't do it, or?
So what I know, which is very little at this point, Armando shared with me a text this morning. I don't know what they use the pension stabilization fund for. I don't know if that's related to ERF and DPFP or just DPFP as a budgeting tool. I'm going to find out that. I'm not worried about it, frankly, because they've got to pay us our contributions. That's the law. And where that comes from, frankly, isn't for the city to figure out. And they've shown me nothing to this point that they're not going to pay our contributions. Yes, I would love them to have a huge pool of money that they're sitting aside for us, because we all know we need the money. But at this point, I'm not worried about getting our contributions, and I will look more into what are they talking about with this fund. From my experience, the non-departmental fund, which is where this stabilization fund is, it's an accounting method or a budgeting method and doesn't really mean a whole lot. So I just need to look more into it for you. Any other questions? Okay.
When does the floor go away?
It technically goes away at the end of 2024, but in effect, it's not going to matter for 2023 or 2024.
Yeah.
Okay. The next item is also a standard item. I think we talked a little bit about this. The trustees want to attend an education class. You just need to let Carol know, and we'll put it on this list. The board will vote on it. And we list classes here that we know that are coming up that might be of interest. And at this one, you can see is what it will look like. Ken said, I have interest in attending this NCFERS public safety conference. He let us know. We put it on the agenda, and the board said, okay, in July. And it will just sit here. After Ken goes to that class, then he'll come back in the next month report on if he thought the conference was worthwhile or not worth his time or whatever. So that's really the process. And I think we talked about that a little before.
And also, don't we have a max on that for trustees?
Yeah, there's a budget for trustee.
What is that? Remind me.
It's kind of complicated, but basically we budget for, how does it work? It's around $3,000 per trustee, but they're basically you can go to an NCFERS or a TechFERS every year, and then if you want to do like a special class, say a Wharton's or something like that, that's one time during your term. It's pretty complicated, is that?
Yeah, no.
We budget an average of 3,000, but we know it's not going to, doesn't flow out evenly that way.
And then Carol sends us the emails when we have hours for those, so y'all should expect that. I know she sent some of those out
right
a while ago.
And in TechFERS, next year is going to be in Austin in April.
Oh, is it?
In the future. Yeah, it's going back to Austin.
Okay.
Josh, are we going to go into?
Is there, do you want to do, is there anything else?
Do you want me to do
for
the executive director's report?
Oh, yeah, the executive director's report first. Got something for
On page 93, there's this item on the agenda that's always on here. This is a Texas thing. It's called the executive director's report. This is a part of the agenda where we're really not supposed to have back and forth conversation. I'm supposed to report out basically certain things. You can ask questions, but it's not supposed to be a big conversation or direction. I don't understand this. Again, it's a Texas thing. So you'll see this is really short, not a lot of substance here, but we always give you the association newsletters. from ANSIPRS, and TexPERS has a newsletter. I report on open records requests and then anything else. So from the last board meeting to this board meeting, we received 4 open records requests. We've completed them all. 3 of them were from news publications, and 1 was from a college, so nothing from members or anything.
What were the news publications requests?
They were for IAC materials and board materials. And they're not uncommon. We get those all the time.
Okay.
So nothing.
Okay, so we're going to go into...
Did you want to do, is there any other public comment before we go to put, do you want to do that again? Just check, John, is there anyone that...
The 5-star on your phone, if you want to call and you can make a public comment.
David, I don't know if you want to comment again.
I'm not saying anything.
All right, let's go into closed session then. Thank you, everybody, who